Alrighty, ready, everybody. More questions from the fine folks at X. Diving straight in, Andy asks, how can we honestly not see life as being created? It is the only option, unless we believe things just appear, which in every other aspect of life is untrue. That's a great question. I appreciate the question. It's a very interesting question. And I myself have been responsible for the creation of products. I've been responsible for the creation of complex computer systems that interact with other complex computer systems. And I've written code to change code and so on. So I've written code that gives birth to other code. And if a third of the time the code that my code gave birth to formatted the computer or destroyed what's called the FAT or the file allocation table so that your hard drive was just a scramble of gloopy mess, that would be a very bad design. A catastrophic failure one third of the time that wiped hard drives would be very bad. And if I tried to say, this is the work of the most incredible, unbelievable, perfect genius known to man, then people would say, you're crazy, right? There's just no way. So the reason I'm saying that, of course, is that, you know, in certain circumstances, about a third of pregnancies die in the womb. Now, God is the greatest craftsman and engineer and designer and enforcer known to man, because not only did God create the design of the human being, but God can also intervene and make sure that a baby, you know, the DNA is good and the cells replicate properly and grow properly, and you're not going to end up with some horrendous miscarriage or ectopic pregnancy or things like that. And so if God loves humanity, and if God designed humanity, and if God has his infinite fingers in every cell division and DNA strand and so on, then why would there be an absolutely catastrophic failure? Like in engineering, right, there's sort of six sigma, like 99.99% error-free and so on. And, you know, a miscarriage is not just, oh, well, you know, the product didn't work. It's like dangerous and heartbreaking and brutal and horrible and so on, right? And, you know, a lot of women have been through these, and it's really, really horrendous. It's one of the most brutal things a woman can go through. And sometimes the baby dies in such a way that it has to be DNC'd out, or the baby dies in such a way that you actually have to give birth to a dead baby, which is really just about one of the most horrifying things that could be imagined in this or any other universe. And this happened to my mother. Between my brother and myself was a female who was stillborn. I don't know what happened, whether it was some Sylvester Stallone forceps problem or something else, but the baby was born dead, which is tragic for my mother. A plus for me, because they tried immediately to have another child who was me, but that is horrendous. I mean, we can go into, you know, childhood cancers and all other kinds of things that could be talked about. Why do half of men 60 and above have enlarged prostates? I don't know. It's not, you know, it just seems like a weird design issue. God could easily, of course, design eyes so that they didn't age in the same, like in the sort of typical way that if you're not bono with glaucoma, you need glasses and so on. And God could do all of that. Why is there a balding? You know, why, you know, just generally, there's questions of design and efficiency. Why do we have an appendix still? You know, this kind of stuff, right? So if you're going to say, well, the miracle of the human body means that God designed and created human beings, then you have a problem, because there are significant issues with the existing human form. I mean, what was it? A friend of mine who was older than me when I was in my early 30s and he was in his mid-late 40s, he said, yeah, you know, you get into your late 40s and you've got teeth problems and your parents get sick, right? And of course, you read Angela's Ashes, this novel, and like people are pulling out teeth on a regular basis. is it not possible that there could have been a better design for human beings than teeth that get rotten, put you in agony, had to be pulled through most of human history, and so on? People say, ah, yes, but there was less sugar and so on. Yeah, but God, of course, knew that we were going to discover sugar, that we were going to, he designed our bodies to really like sugar and fat and salt and so on, right? So with regards to the design of the human body, our backs are not great because we evolved as quadrupeds. Our knees are not great because, again, we evolved as quadrupeds. One of the things that happened that allowed us to grow our brains was we no longer went around on all fours, but we stood up, which exposes less of the body area to the sun, which allows more water to use and cool our brain. And so that's one of the reasons we were able to develop larger brains and so on. So if you're going to say that human beings are evidence of ultimate genius, perfect design, but of course human beings have 100% failure rate over time, and again, a third of pregnancies end in miscarriage, and throughout almost all of human history, half of babies and toddlers died before the age of 5, and wretched, horrible diseases and infections and so on. Now, if you're going to say that is the very greatest possible design, then you have a challenge in that human beings design very complex things with a massive success rate. I mean, the old Intel chips, the 66, the 50, the 33, the 25, they just make them as fast as possible. They test how fast they could reliably run, and then they slapped a speed sticker on them. But most of them worked, and there was a failure in floating point tables. I think under Andy Grove, back in the day, he wrote a book about strategic inflection points and how to manage disasters, which actually is a pretty good book. But the success rate of manufacturing aims to be very high. If you bought a computer, and a third of the time that you bought the computer, it blew up and burned you, you would consider that very bad design. You would consider that highly dangerous. And a computer blowing up and harming you is in many ways less traumatic and bad for you than a baby dying in your womb for a woman, right? It's very, very difficult, very tough, especially if it's later on in the pregnancy. If you were an investor in a company and they were producing complex machinery and they said, well, a third of the time, like, it's not just that it fails, because again, just to hop on this issue, the miscarriage is brutal for the woman and dangerous as well. So it's more than just, oh, my computer didn't turn on. But if you had a third failure rate, right, every time they produced a product, 1 out of 3 was dangerous, not just didn't work, but was dangerous, you'd never invest. And if you were to say, this is the very highest possible rate of manufacturing success that could be achieved, they would say, well, no. And if you say, well, listen, I'm the best engineer and product manager and specialist and creator in the known universe throughout all of human history, they'd say, yeah, but a lot of people have 99% success rate. So what are you talking about? A one-third failure rate is extremely dangerous as the very best that can be done. So it's tough, man. It's tough to make that case because remember, God is all-knowing, all-powerful, and morally perfect. That is a pretty freaking high bar to have. God is all-powerful, all-knowing, and morally perfect. So how could he design babies that die in the wombs, children that get cancer, children I once knew, a family, the daughter got meningitis, and it ate away massive chunks of her brain, and she was, like a tenth of a person for the rest of her life, and suffered enormously, and died relatively young, and it's like, oh my, you can't do better than that? You can't do better than that? Is that all-knowing, all-morally perfect, all-powerful, the best that could possibly be achieved? Well, of course, we know it's not the best that could possibly be achieved because human beings achieve better. Now, of course, human beings don't make things as complex as a human being. I get that. However, that doesn't matter because God is infinitely more knowledgeable, infinitely more powerful, and infinitely more good. And therefore, the complexity of humanity means nothing. Of course, it would mean something relative to a human mind, but it means absolutely nothing. There is zero difference between some knowledge and less knowledge to perfect knowledge, right? Because it's infinity, perfection, size, strength, and power. So the fact that human beings manufacture things less complex than a human being to God's all-knowing and all-powerful nature is completely irrelevant, because God can make human beings perfectly functional. Now, of course, one of the answers, or the arguments, of course, is that you say, or people say, and what the Bible says, that in the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve did not experience illness or sickness, or there was no pregnancy, and so on. And then when Eve listened to Satan, and then Adam, like most men, was unable to resist a woman telling him what to do while being naked, then they were kicked out of the Garden of Eden, flaming swords were placed in the way, and Eve was cursed with childbirth, Adam was cursed with labor, and that's why everything went to hell in a handbasket, so to speak, and that's why babies die in the womb and children get cancer and so on. Well, that's kind of tricky, right? Morally, that's kind of tricky. First of all, God is all-knowing, and therefore God knew that Eve was going to succumb to Satan and eat the tree of knowledge of good and evil, eat of the apple of the tree of knowledge and good and evil. And so God knew who's going to do that. And also, of course, God designed Eve and Adam to be susceptible. So, yes, but they have free will and so on. Yes, but God knows everything that's going to come. So the story really doesn't hang together. Still better than the Odyssey, though. The Odyssey, my God, what a mess. So God designed human beings, and they then ended up being susceptible to Satan. And so you could punish them, but why should I be punished? You know, 8,000, 10,000 years after the Garden of Eden, why do a third of babies die in the womb? Sorry to my friend who's pregnant. Ignore this. It's not going to happen to you. But two friends, actually. So why? Why would a baby have to suffer for what Eve did 10,000 years ago? That would not be moral. But God is perfectly moral. You can't punish babies in the womb for what Eve chose to do 10,000 years ago. That would be, that's completely immoral. So it's a tough standard. If you're going to say God is all-knowing and all-powerful, the perfect engineer, and can intervene without any effort whatsoever to make things perfect, then why do things go wrong? It's not a matter of moral punishment, because babies in the womb are dying, but they're not being morally punished for anything. So you can't answer these questions. But I certainly respect you trying to ask. All right. Now, let us get to the next question. Do you believe in marital grape as a concept? Essay these days, apparently. I don't know. I'm so inconsistent, it probably doesn't matter, but I'll do it anyway. So, do you believe in marital SA as a concept? Well, of course you cannot impose your sexual will on someone against their will. It doesn't matter if they're married to you or not. It doesn't matter. So, of course, yes. I mean, the fact that a man is married to a woman and a woman is married to a man does not invalidate the non-aggression principle. You cannot sign away all of your future rights, and you cannot sign into an agreement that says, I'm going to be a slave. You cannot sign into an agreement that says, I'm going to agree for the rest of time to permit SA in this kind of way. Of course, if a woman agrees to this in the sort of weird kind of, you can invite people to simulate this kind of stuff, these kinds of attacks on you. And if a woman does that, then, I mean, that's weird, and she really needs some moral and philosophical help. But if you agree to it, that would be like kind of a role play, and that would be like a woman who's being paid for some kind of SA scene in a movie. It would not actually be SA because she's agreed to it and is doing it voluntarily. But no, of course, it doesn't matter if you're married or not. If the woman or the man does not want to have sex, then you have no right to pressure or force the woman. Well, pressure is a bit, I mean, you can be a little bit persistent in, I think we should, and try and seduce her or whatever it is, right? But of course, if the woman says no, then you don't have the activity. So yes, I completely agree with that. Women and men, of course, I think it's a little bit more on the female side, they have complete sexual autonomy and should never be forced into any kind of sexual activity of any kind. That's fine. And the man, of course, should not be forced to transfer resources to the woman at any time, whether it is during the marriage, whether it is after children come along. The woman has no right to force the man to provide her any resources. There should be no such thing as an alimony. There should be no such thing as child support. Now, of course, maybe if you write some sort of prenup, some sort of stuff like that, then that's another matter. Then it's sort of contractual and so on. But the transfer of money should never be coerced in any marital relationship, and the sexual activity should never be coerced in any kind of relationship. Of course, again, if you sign a contract, I don't think you can sign a contract to say, I will never be able to say no to sexual activity for the rest of my life. I don't think that's really right. But you do not owe people anything. There are no unchosen positive obligations, right? So you can choose to sign a contract and provide work and get paid and so on. So you owe the work and they owe you the money. But there are no unchosen positive obligations. You can't be forced to do anything that you hadn't explicitly chosen for. So, all right, let's see here. Did the bans on dueling result in men being emboldened to spread lies, and has this negatively impacted our culture? Is legalized dueling an important negative feedback mechanism for men to police each other's behavior with? Bans on dueling. That's interesting. So if two men voluntarily decide to have a shootout, is that a violation of the non-aggression principle? I mean, it's boxing with bullets, right? So two men can obviously decide to go at each other in a boxing match. They can go and fight all kinds of people and so on, right? Mixed martial arts and taekwondo and jujitsu and so on. So I don't know. That's an interesting question. So the non-aggression principle, can you voluntarily go into a shoot each other fatal encounter? I would say that you have the right to do that, since the outcome will very likely be severe injury or death to one party. You can do that. I don't know if you would, I'd feel super comfortable with people doing that if they have children, right? Because you kind of have to be around for your children. I think bans on dueling probably make sense as a whole, but what I would say is that what needs to be changed in the legal system is defamation. Defamation is very tough to prove in many situations. And of course, in America, especially if you're a public figure, then you need to prove that the standard is like actual malice, or you need to prove reckless disregard for the truth. And of course, everybody who's in the media knows all of that. And so it's very hard to, if you destroy someone's reputation, it's very hard to get any kind of restitution, any kind of punishment. Wikipedia is surrounded by a bunch of legal structures that make it very hard to do that kind of stuff with. So I think rather than legalizing dueling, which is tricky, I would say that what should happen is it should be easier to sue people for defamation. If you say something that is recognized as a slur about someone, then you should be able to force them to retract it and pay damages, right? So if you call someone a racist and they don't fit that, or you call someone a white supremacist is someone who believes that white people should violently rule over other races. And of course, I think that's repulsive, but I've been called that. So, but of course, in the courts are generally run by leftists, and leftists want to have these weapons available to them. So in general, the courts have ruled that calling someone, I mean, this is not legal advice, this is just my understanding, that calling someone, say, some terrible slur is just, it's protected opinion. It's just like calling someone a jerk. But, you know, if the sort of campaign against me, which went on for almost half a decade, I mean, longer really, but the sort of focused one was from 2016 to 2020. If the campaign against me resulted in me losing livelihood and you know, a third of my life's work got sucked into the ether, and so on. Well, slurs should be able to be subject to legal challenges. Like if somebody calls you terrible names that have a negative effect on your life and reputation, then there should be legal structures in place to deal with that. And it's just crazy difficult, crazy expensive. I mean, there was an interesting post the other day where someone said, you know, go to a lawyer and ask that lawyer, how many times have you personally sued someone? And most of them will say no, because the lawyers know. And of course, they get free legal representation in a way. It just costs them time. But most lawyers don't want to get involved in that kind of stuff. So the legal system is very bad at handling this kind of stuff. The other thing, too, is bans on dueling is tough, because dueling could be used to attack people for telling the truth as well, right? So that's tough. All right. What are acceptable roles for women in society so that they don't become, you know, bad, bad, bad? So I don't know what you mean by acceptable roles. I know that morally, women should not be able to use the power of the state or any other coercive mechanism to extract resources from others, largely men, right? The modern economy in general exists to sell children on the Aztec block of foreign banksters in order to shovel mountains of money into the arms of women to make them loyal to the state rather than to the local men in their community. And so I'm not sure what you mean by acceptable roles for women in society. Women are subject to the non-aggression principle, just as men are. And so women should do whatever they want, as long as it's not initiating the use of force or theft and taking from people, right? So do what you want, just don't do evil. Somebody says, have you noticed that there's a lot of overlap between libertarians and people who experience substantial abuse or neglect as children? Do you think it could be that people who are mistreated by their parents as children are more inclined to consider that governing authorities may be working against their best interests? I assume by there you mean the children here. Well, yeah, I mean, so one of the things that happens if you're abused as a child is the abuser gets away with it. The abuser is supported by the church, the schools, the family, the extended family, society as a whole, and society as a whole tells you to be loyal to your abusers if you're a child. And so what you realize is that society is not moral, society is not good, and it only talks about these things as a form of camouflage. So if society loves government and society hates virtue, then the government can't be virtuous. If morality exists objectively without the presence of humans necessary, then why does it exist as a fundamental property of existence? If morality exists objectively, no, morality does not exist objectively. It's not like a table or a tree or a light bulb. Morality does not exist objectively. Logic, reason does not exist objectively. Numbers do not exist objectively. But these things aren't subjective, right? Just because something doesn't exist objectively, it doesn't mean it's subjective. So think of a shadow cast by a statue, right? So if a shadow is cast by a statue, the shadow doesn't exist. It's really just the absence of light. The shadow doesn't exist as a thing unto itself. You can't carve the shadow and take it with you in your pocket or something like that. So the shadow doesn't exist objectively, but that doesn't mean that the shadow is subjective. So the shadow that's cast by a statue of a man on horseback shows some slightly distended or extended version of the statue of the man on horseback. If there's a statue of a man on horseback and the sun is casting the shadow right to the left of the statue of the man on horseback, then you don't see a woman dancing in the shadow, right? So the shadow doesn't exist. The shadow is the absence of light because the statue is blocking the light. So the shadow doesn't exist as an independent thing. But the shadow is not subjective. The shadow is cast by the statue. So it has to follow the properties of the statue. So just because something doesn't exist objectively doesn't mean that it is subjective. I mean, some things that don't exist objectively are subjective, right? So what language do orcs speak? Well, orcs don't exist objectively, and so whatever language you say they speak can't be proven or disproven. You'd want it to be consistent in the book. You don't want them speaking orcish, then elvish, then dwarven, and so on. But some things that don't exist are not objective, like nightly dreams. Some things that don't exist are objective. Right, the scientific method, mathematics, and so on, and morality. So I hope that helps. on travel. Is my fear of flying with my family to the other side of the world well-founded? Is it worth it for a trip to see family, having little kids in safety at home and risking it? Yeah, a lot of people have a fear of flying. Was that an Erica Jong novel from the 70s? A lot of people do have a fear of flying.
Generally, I think it is a trust. It's a trust issue. So you have to trust physics. You have to trust the airplane manufacturer, the mechanics, the maintenance. You have to trust the pilot and the air traffic controllers. So if you're not used to trusting people, flying is really tough. Though, of course, flying is safer than driving. Like, you're more at risk, I think, driving to the airport than flying in an airplane. So it's a matter of trust. I would look at trust issues as a whole. People have betrayed you or broken your trust in the past. All right. Siriani asks, every epistemology is grounded in faith. So what do you have faith in? No, I don't think so. I don't believe everything is grounded in faith. I accept sense evidence as universal and empirical and objective, and I don't believe that's faith. Faith is belief against reason and evidence. And so if you accept reason and evidence, it's not faith. Somebody asks, why is anything here at all? But why does not specifically relate to physical objects? You know, why is this rock here? Like, you walk along a beach, you see a little rock. Why is this rock here? But there's no why. It has simply rested on the beach as the result of impersonal forces of a tide and wind and current and momentum and so on, right? So there is no why. There is no why to mere physical processes. Why is the sun here? Well, there is no why. You can ask why to people. Why did you do that? Oh, well, I thought this, or I assumed that, or I expected this, or that, or the other, right? So you can ask why of people. But there is no why to physical forces. Now, of course, you can say, well, why does the sun burn? Okay, you get nuclear reactors at its core, nuclear reactions at its core, and so on. So you can, why are there the northern lights? And so you have an answer. But the why is what causes it, not why is it, if that makes sense. What causes weight gain? Why did I gain weight? Okay, you can look at the calorie excess and so on. So why is anything here at all is not a question that makes any sense philosophically. You can ask people why they did things. Why did you cheat on your wife? Well, there's some reasoning behind that, some thoughts behind that, and so on. But why is the rock there on the beach? There is no why to that. It just is the result of blind domino-based physical forces. How can individualism ever be a primary value in society when collectives outcompete individuals, so there's always an inherent incentive for a degree of collectivism? Well, of course, well-organized collectives are going to beat an individual in almost every circumstance. I mean, if you're playing doubles, but your partner doesn't show up, and then they say, let's just play doubles, but with only you. So there's two people on one side, one person on the other. The two people are almost certain, if everyone's got the same level of skill, give or take, the doubles are going to win. Like, the two people are going to win against one person because the one person has to run all over the court and the two people cover half the court. So yes, two people will, or more, will almost certainly outcompete a one person, you know, in general, all things being relatively equal. So for sure, individualism is not that the individual automatically has more value than the group. Individualism says individuals exist, the group does not. Concepts do not exist in the world, right? Trees exist, a forest. The concept forest is in our mind. So individualism, as far as I understand it, does not mean that one person can beat 100 people in a sword fight or some sort of jujitsu competition. It says that only individuals exist. Now, individuals that choose to get together and organize and so on, like I'm organized and get together with my wife in terms of having a marriage and so on. So you can get together, you can group together, you can have a great collective movements, you can all band together and so on. There's nothing wrong with that. That's totally fine. But individualism is simply that only individual human beings exist. The collective does not exist in an empirical and physical way. Who owns Data from Star Trek The Next Generation? I don't know that enough. Sorry, I don't know the show enough. Next, why are all the most famous philosophers childless or absent fathers? Where is the great corpus of philosophy from successful fathers? Why is this distinction not front and center during philosophical education? Well, I mean, it's having a matter of a time as well, right? So if you're childless or an absent father, then you have a lot more time to write and think and so on. And a lot of times philosophers have donors, like there would be some rich viscount or something who would find a philosopher. There would be a certain amount of work that would have to be produced. And I think it also gives philosophers an incomplete or bad understanding of the development of reason in people. I mean, once you have children, and if you have more than one children, it's even better, you get to see how reason develops in children. And the other thing too, if there were philosophers who wrote about morals in childhood, like the morals of parents, the morals of childhood, they probably got scrubbed from history. I mean, they sure as heck have tried to scrub me from history, and I'm a philosopher who focuses on childhood and the morality of parenting. And there are so many bad parents out there that they just will be hostile to that. Once you achieve your dreams, how to create new ones? Well, if your dreams are big enough, you can't achieve them, right? So my dream is of a moral, virtuous universe with stateless societies and peaceful parenting. So just, if you've achieved your dreams, you haven't set them high enough. So just set bigger and higher dreams. Give an argument against segregation, seriously against it. And here's the sweet sweat part. You have to be honest. Here's the brain sweat part. Give an argument against segregation. Oh, so you mean dividing ethnicities and not allowing them to live together? Well, I don't think that that's right. I think you should not initiate the use of force to keep ethnicities and races apart. I think you should not initiate the use of force to force them together, and you should not initiate force to force them apart. You should not have censorship, and people should be able to discuss the strengths and weaknesses of every ethnicity, and almost every ethnicity has strengths and weaknesses. And then you should allow people, I mean, if you want to create an enclave of only redheaded people, you can do that if you want. It's not a violation of the initiation of force and so on. So, do you believe in reincarnation or one and done for our spirit soul? I do not believe in reincarnation. Your stupid post about having children or not kind of disqualifies you as a deep thinker. Well, Torsten, that's not an argument. You can engage with the content of what it is that I'm saying, or you can just say, you're disqualified as a deep thinker. And it's like, that's just so shallow and stupid. Sorry, I'm not saying you're stupid, but this particular post is just shallow and stupid. I make a case, and of course it's not a perfect case because I'm trying to write in a very short way for X. So this idea that you get to qualify me or disqualify me as a deep thinker, I mean, who the hell do you think you are? Are you some godlike arbiter of who's deep and who's not? So just, and you're not even honest, because all you're doing is you're reacting. You're emotionally reacting to what I wrote, and you're troubled and bothered and angry and upset by it, and therefore you're thinking that you get big, some sort of giant planet-spanning check marks or X on who gets to be a deep thinker or not. That's just very sad. All right. So I will finish up here. Again, I really do appreciate, these are great questions. freedomain.com/donate to help out the show. I'd really appreciate it. And don't forget call.freedomain.com to set up a call with me, public or private. It's a free resource if you want it. And I look forward to talking with you. Bye.